Osho, The Dhammapada, The Way of the Buddha, Volume 5, Discourse Number 5.
Bhagwan, love yourself and watch, today, tomorrow, always. First establish yourself in the way, then teach, and so defeat sorrow. To straighten the crooked, you must first do a harder thing, straighten yourself. You are your only master. Who else? Subdue yourself and discover your master. Willfully you have fed your own mischief. Soon it will crush you as the diamond crushes stone. By your own folly you will be brought as low as your worst enemy wishes. So the creeper chokes the tree. How hard it is to serve yourself. How easy to lose yourself in mischief and folly. The kashta reed dies when it bears fruit. So the fool, scorning the teachings of the awakened, spurning those who follow the law, perishes when his folly flowers.
We begin with one of the most profound sutras of Gautam the Buddha. Love yourself. Just the opposite has been taught to you by all the traditions of the world, all the civilizations, all the cultures, all the churches. They say, love others. Don't love yourself. And there is a certain cunning strategy behind their teaching. Love is the nourishment for the soul. Just as food is to the body, so is love to the soul. Without food, the body is weak. Without love, the soul is weak. And no state, no church, no vested interest has ever wanted people to have strong souls. Because a person with a spiritual energy is bound to be rebellious. Love makes you rebellious, revolutionary. Love gives you wings to soar high. Love gives you insight into things, and nobody can deceive you, exploit you, oppress you. And the priests and the politicians survive only on your blood. They survive only on exploitation. They are parasites. All the priests and all the politicians. To make you spiritually weak, they have found a sure method, 100% guaranteed. And that is to teach you not to love yourself. Because if a man cannot love himself, he cannot love anybody else either. the teaching is very tricky. They say love others because they know. If you cannot love yourself, you cannot love at all. But they go on saying love others. Love humanity. Love God. Love nature. Love your wife, your husband, your children, your parents. But don't love yourself. Because to love oneself is selfish according to them. And they condemn self-love as they condemn nothing else. And they have made their teaching look very logical. They say if you love yourself, you will become an egoist. If you love yourself, you will become narcissistic. It is not true. A man who loves himself finds that there is no ego in him. It is loving others without loving yourself, trying to love others, that the ego arises. The missionaries, the social reformers, the social servants have the greatest egos in the world. Naturally, because they think themselves to be superior human beings. They are not ordinary. Ordinary people love themselves. They love others. They love great ideals. They love God. And all their love is false. Because all their love is without any roots. A man who loves himself takes the first step towards real love. It is like throwing a pebble in a silent lake. The first circular ripples will arise around the pebble, very close to the pebble, naturally. Where else they can arise? And then they will go on spreading. To the farthest shore they will reach. If you stop those ripples arising close to the pebble, then there will be no more ripples at all. Then you cannot hope to create ripples reaching to the farthest source. It is impossible. And the priests and the politicians became aware of the phenomenon. Stop people loving themselves and you have destroyed their capacity to love. Now whatsoever they will think is love will be only pseudo. It may be duty but not love. And duty is a four-letter dirty word. Parents are fulfilling their duties towards their children. And then, in return, children will fulfill their duties towards their parents. The wife is dutiful towards the husband, and the husband is dutiful towards the wife. Where is love? Love knows nothing of duty. Duty is a burden. A formality. Love is joy, a sharing. Love is informal. The lover never feels that he has done enough. The lover always feels more was possible. The lover never feels that I have obliged the other. On the contrary, he feels that because of my love has been received, I am obliged. The other has obliged me by receiving my gift, by not rejecting it. The man of duty thinks that I am higher, spiritual, extraordinary. Look how I serve people. These servants of the people are the most pseudo people in the world and most mischievous too. If we can get rid of the public servants, humanity will be unburdened, will feel very light, will be able to dance again, sing again. But for centuries your roots have been cut, poisoned. You have been made afraid of ever being in love with yourself, which is the first step of love and the first experience. A man who loves himself respects himself. And a man who loves himself and respects himself respects others too. Because he knows, just as I am, so are others. Just as I enjoy love, respect, dignity, others enjoy. He becomes aware that we are not different. As far as the fundamentals are concerned, we are one. We are under the same law. Es dhammo sanantano. Buddha says, we live under the same eternal law. In details, we may be a little bit different from each other, which brings variety, which is beautiful. But in the foundations, we are part of one nature. The man who loves himself enjoys the love so much, becomes so blissful that the love starts overflowing. It starts reaching others. It has to reach. If you live love, you have to share it. You cannot go on loving yourself forever. Because one thing will become absolutely clear to you, that if loving one person, yourself, is so tremendously ecstatic and beautiful, how much more ecstasy is waiting for you if you start sharing your love with many, many people. Slowly the ripples start reaching farther and farther. You love other people, then you start loving animals, birds, trees, rocks. You can fill the whole universe with your love. A single person is enough to fill the whole universe with love, just as a single pebble can fill the whole lake with ripples. A small pebble. Only a Buddha can say, love yourself. No priest, no politician can agree with it. Because this is destroying their whole edifice, their whole structure of exploitation. If a man is not allowed to love himself, his spirit, his soul becomes weaker and weaker every day. His body may grow, but he has no inner growth, because he has no inner nourishment. He remains a body almost without a soul, or only with a potentiality, a possibility of a soul. The soul remains a seed, and it will remain a seed if you cannot find the right soil of love for it. And you will not find if you follow the stupid idea that don't love yourself. I also teach my sannyasins to love themselves first. It has nothing to do with ego. In fact, love is such a light that the darkness of the ego cannot exist at all. If you love others, if your love is focused on others, you will live in darkness. Turn your light towards yourself first. Become light unto yourself first. Let the light dispel your inner darkness, inner weakness. Let the love make you a tremendous power, a spiritual force. And once your soul is powerful, you know you are not going to die. You are immortal. You are eternal. Love gives you the first insight into eternity. Love is the only experience that transcends time. That's why lovers are not afraid of death. Love knows no death. A single moment of love is more than a whole eternity. But love has to begin from the very beginning. Love has to start with this first step. Love yourself. Don't condemn yourself. You have been condemned so much. And you have accepted all that condemnation. Now you go on doing the harm to yourself. Nobody thinks himself worthy enough. Nobody thinks himself a beautiful creation of God. Nobody thinks himself that he is needed at all. These are poisonous ideas. But you have been poisoned. You have been poisoned with your mother's milk. And this has been your whole past. Humanity has lived under a dark, dark cloud of self-condemnation. If you condemn yourself, how can you grow? How you can ever become mature? And if you condemn yourself, how can you worship existence? If you cannot worship existence in you, you will become incapable of worshipping existence in others. It will be impossible. You can become part of the whole only if you have great respect of the God that resides within you. You are a host God is your guest. By loving yourself, you will know this, that God has chosen you to be a vehicle. In choosing you to be a vehicle, He has already respected you, loved you. In creating you, He has sown His love for you. He has made you. Not accidentally. He has made you with a certain destiny, with a certain potential, with a certain glory that you have to attain. Yes, God has created man in His own image. Man has to become a God. Unless man becomes God, there is going to be no fulfillment, no contentment. But how can you become a God? Your priests say that you are a sinner. Your priests say that you are doomed, that you are bound to go to hell. And they make you very much afraid of loving yourself. This is their trick, to cut the very root of love. And then they are very cunning people. The most cunning profession in the world is that of the priest. Then he says, love others. Now it is going to be plastic, synthetic, a pretense, a performance. They say, now love humanity, your mother country, your motherland, life, existence, God, big words, but utterly meaningless. Have you ever come across humanity? You always come across human beings. And you have condemned the first human being that you came across. That is you. You have not respected yourself, not loved yourself. Now your whole life will be wasted in condemning others. That's why people are such great fault finders. They find fault with themselves. How can they avoid not finding the same faults in others? In fact, they will find them and they will magnify them. They will make them as bigger as possible. That seems to be the only saving device. Somehow, to save your face, you have to do it. That's why there is so much criticism. And such a lake of love. I say this is one of the most profound sutras of Buddha. And only an awakened person can give you such an insight. He says, love yourself. This can become the foundation of a radical transformation. Don't be afraid of loving yourself. Love totally. and you will be surprised. The day you can get rid of all self-condemnation, self-disrespect, the day you can get rid of the idea of the original sin, the day you can think yourself as worthy and loved by God, will be a day of great blessing. From that day onwards, you will start seeing people in their true light, and you will have compassion. And it will not be a compassion cultivated, it will be a natural, spontaneous flow. And a person who loves himself can become easily meditative, because meditation means being with yourself. If you hate yourself, as you do, as you have been told to do, and you have been following it religiously, if you hate yourself, how you can be with yourself? And meditation is nothing but enjoying your beautiful aloneness, celebrating yourself. That's what meditation is all about. Meditation is not a relationship. The other is not needed at all. One is enough unto oneself. One is bathed in one's own glory, bathed in one's own light. One is simply joyous because one is alive, because one is. The greatest miracle in the world is that you are, that I am. To be is the greatest miracle. And meditation opens the door of this great miracle. But a man who loves himself can only meditate. Otherwise, you are always escaping from yourself, avoiding yourself. Who wants to look at an ugly face? And who wants to penetrate into an ugly being? Who wants to go deep into one's own mud, into one's own darkness? Who wants to enter into the hell that you think you are? You want to keep this whole thing covered up with beautiful flowers. And you want always to escape from yourself. Hence, people are seeking company continuously. They can't be with themselves. They want to be with others. People are seeking any type of company. If they can avoid the company of themselves, anything will do. They will sit into a movie house for 3 hours, seeing something utterly stupid. They will read a detective novel for hours, wasting their time. They will read the same newspaper again and again, just to keep themselves engaged. They will play playing cards and chess just to kill time, as if they have too much time. We don't have too much time. We don't have time enough to grow, to be, to rejoice. But this is one of the basic problems created by a wrong upbringing. Avoid yourself. People are sitting before their TVs, glued to their chairs for 4, 5, even 6 hours. The average American is seeing TV 5 hours per day. And this disease is going to spread all over the world. And what you are seeing, and what you are getting, burning your eyes, because TV is the first thing in the world in which you have to look at the very source of the light. Ordinarily, you never look at the light itself. You look at lighted objects. You don't look at the sun. You look at the rose. The sun is shining on the rose. You look at the green trees. You look at people's faces. You don't look at the electric bulb itself. You look at the painting on the wall. You will not be able to see the painting if the light is not there. But you don't look at the direct source of light, because that burns your very delicate mechanism of the eye. Now in TV, you are looking at the direct source of the light. A movie is far better than TV, because at least you are not looking at the direct source of light. TV is creating so many diseases. Now they are suspecting even cancer may be one of those diseases caused by TV. And few more new diseases are bound to be discovered soon. Because the generation that is looking at TV for 5, 6 hours per day is growing up. The new generation will bring a new generation of diseases too. But this has been always so. Even if the TV was not there, there were other things. The problem is the same. How to avoid oneself? Because one feels so ugly. And who has made you so ugly? Your so-called religious people, your popes, your Shankaracharyas, they are responsible for distorting your face. And they have succeeded. They have made everybody ugly. Each child is born beautiful, and then we start distorting his beauty, crippling him in many ways, paralyzing him in many ways, distorting his proportion, making him unbalanced. Sooner or later, he becomes so much disgusted with himself that he is ready to be with anybody. He may go to a prostitute just to avoid himself. Love yourself, says Buddha, and this can transform the whole world. It can destroy the whole ugly past. It can herald a new age. it can be the beginning of a new humanity. Hence my insistence on love. But love begins with yourself. Then it can go on spreading. It goes on spreading on its own accord. You need not do anything to spread it. Love yourself, says Buddha, and then immediately he adds, and watch. That is meditation. That is Buddha's name for meditation. But the first requirement is love yourself, and then watch. If you don't love yourself and start watching, you may feel like committing suicide. Many Buddhists feel like committing suicide because they don't pay attention to the first part of the sutra. They immediately jump to the second. Watch yourself. In fact, I have never come across a single commentary on Dhammapada, on these sutras of the Buddha, which has paid any attention to the first part. Love yourself. Socrates says, know thyself. Buddha says, love thyself. And Buddha is far more truer. Because unless you love thyself, you will never know thyself. Knowing comes only later on. Love prepares the ground. Love is the possibility of knowing oneself. Love is the right way to know oneself. I was staying once with a Buddhist monk, Jagdish Kashyap. Now he is dead. He was a good man. We were talking about Dhammapada, and we came across this sutra, and he started talking about watching. As if he has not read at all the first part. No traditional Buddhist ever pays any attention to the first part. He simply bypasses it. I said to Bhikshu, Jagdish Kashyap, wait. You are overlooking something very essential. Watching is a second step, and you are making it a first step, and it cannot be the first step. Then he read the sutra again, and he said, with mystified eyes, that I have been reading Dhammapada my whole life, and I must have read this sutra millions of times. It is my everyday morning prayers to go through Dhammapada. I can repeat it simply by memory. But I have never thought that love thyself is the first part of meditation and watching is the second part. And this is the case of millions of Buddhists all over the world. And this is the case with neo-Buddhists also, because in the West now Buddhism is spreading. The time for Buddha has come in the West. Now the West is ready to understand Buddha. And the same mistake is being done there too. Nobody thinks that love thyself has to be the foundation of knowing thyself, of watching thyself. Because unless you love, you cannot face yourself. You will avoid. Your watching may itself become a way of avoiding yourself. First love thyself and watch. Today, tomorrow, always. Create loving energy around yourself. Love your body. Love your mind. Love your whole mechanism, whole organism. By love is meant accept it as it is. Don't try to repress. We repress only when we hate something. When we repress only when we are against something. Don't repress, because if you repress, how you are going to watch? And we cannot look eye to eye to the enemy. We can look only in the eyes of our beloved. If you are not a lover of yourself, you will not be able to look into your own eyes, into your own face, into your own reality. Watching is meditation. Buddha's name for meditation. Watch is Buddha's watchword. He said, be aware, be alert, don't be unconscious, don't behave in a sleepy way, don't go on functioning like a machine, like a robot. That's how people are functioning. Mike had just moved into his apartment and decided he should get acquainted with his across-the-hall neighbor. When the door was opened, he was delightfully surprised to see a beautiful young blonde bulging out of a skimpy see-through negligee. Mike looked her squarely in the eye and ad-libbed, "Hi, I'm your new sugar across the hall. Can I borrow a cup of neighbor?" People are living unconsciously. What they are saying, what they are doing, they are not aware, they are not watchful. People go on guessing, not seeing. They don't have any insight. They can't have. Insight arises only through great watchfulness. Then you can see even with closed eyes. Right now you can't see even with open eyes. You guess. You infer. You impose. You project. Grace lay on the psychiatrist's couch. "Close your eyes and relax," said the shrink. "And I will try an experiment." He took a leather key case from his pocket, flipped it open, and shook the keys. What did that sound remind you of? He asked. Sex, she whispers. Then he closed his key case and touched it to the girl's upturned palm. Her body stiffened. And what? Asked the psychiatrist. Sex, Grace murmured nervously. Now open your eyes, instructed the doctor, and tell me why. What I did was sexually evocative to you. Hesitantly, her eyelids flickered open. Grace saw the key case in the psychiatrist's hand and blushed scarlet. Well, to begin with, she stammered, I thought that first sound was your zipper opening. Your mind is constantly projecting itself. Your mind is constantly interfering with reality, giving it a color, shape and form which is not its own. Your mind never allows you to see that which is. It allows you to see only that which it wants to see. Just 20 years before, scientists used to think that our eyes and ears and nose and our other senses and the mind are nothing but openings to reality, bridges to reality. But within 20 years, last 20 years, the whole understanding has changed. Now they say our senses and our mind are not really openings to reality, but guards against it. Only 2% of reality ever gets through these guards into you. 98% reality is prevented outside. And the 2% that reaches to you and to your being is no more the same. It has to pass through so many barriers. It has to conform to so many mind things that by the time it reaches to you, it is no more itself. Meditation means putting the mind aside, so that it no more interferes with reality and you can see things as they are. Why the mind interferes at all? Because the mind is created by the society. It is the society's agent within you. It is not in your service, remember. It is your mind, but it is not in your service. It is in conspiracy against you. It has been conditioned by the society. Society has implanted many things in it. It is your mind, but no more functions as a servant to you. It functions as a servant to the society. If you are a Christian, then it functions as an agent of the Christian church. If you are a Hindu, then your mind is Hindu. If you are a Buddhist, your mind is a Buddhist. And the reality is neither Christian, nor Hindu, nor Buddhist. The reality is simply as it is. And you have to put these minds aside. the communist mind, the fascist mind, the Catholic mind, the Protestant mind. There are 3,000 religions on the earth. Big religions and small religions and very small sects and sects within sects. 3,000 in all. So there exist 3,000 of minds, types, and reality is one, and God is one, and truth is one. Meditation means put the mind aside and watch. The first step, love yourself, will help you tremendously. By loving yourself, you will have destroyed much that the society has implanted upon you. You would have become freer from the society and its conditioning. And the second step is now watch. Just watch. Buddha does not say what has to be watched. Everything. Walking, watch your walking. Eating, watch your eating. Taking a shower, watch your. The water, the cold water falling on you, the touch of the water, the coldness, the shiver that goes in the spine. Watch everything. Today, tomorrow, always. A moment comes finally when you can watch even your sleep. That is the ultimate in watching. The body goes to sleep and there is still a watcher awake, silently watching the fast sleeping body. That is the ultimate in watching. Right now, just the opposite is the case. Your body is awake, but you are asleep. Then you will be awake and the body will be asleep. And the body needs rest. And your consciousness needs no sleep. Your consciousness is consciousness. It is alertness. It is its very nature. The body tires. Because the body lives under the law of gravitation. It is gravitation that makes you tired. That's why running fast you will be tired soon. Going up stairs you will be tired soon. Because the gravitation pulls you downwards. In fact, to stand is tiring. To sit is tiring. When you lie down, flat, horizontal, then only there is little rest for the body. Because now you are in tune with the law of gravitation. When you are standing vertical, you are against the law. The blood is going towards the head against the law. The heart has to pump hard. So when you have a heart attack, the doctors suggest a long rest period. Just lie down, horizontal, Snoopy style. That will keep you in tune with the gravitation. Otherwise, gravitation is tiring. But consciousness does not function under the law of gravitation. Hence, it never gets tired. Gravitation has no power over consciousness. It is not a rock. It has no weight. It functions under a totally different law, the law of grace. Or as it is known in the East, the law of levitation. Gravitation means pulling downwards. Levitation means pulling upwards. The body is being pulled continuously downwards. That's why finally it will have to lie down in the grave. That will be the real rest for it. Dust unto dust. The body has returned back to its source. The turmoil has ceased. Now there is no conflict. Your atoms of the body will have real rest only in the grave. The soul soars higher and higher. As you become watchful, you start having wings. Then the whole sky is yours. Man is a meeting of the earth and the sky, of body and soul. First establish yourself in the way, then teach, and so defeat sorrow. Each sutra is pregnant with great meaning. First Buddha says, love yourself and watch. And immediately he reminds to his disciples, first establish yourself in the way. He says, mind you, don't start teaching what I am telling to you. The mind plays so many games. And the ultimate game is the game of becoming a teacher. It is difficult, arduous to transform yourself. It is very easy to teach others. It is difficult to be a disciple. It is very easy to be a teacher. Because the disciple has to surrender. And the teacher can have all his ego. In fact, he can have more ego because so many people surrendering to him. Unless he has become established in the way, that means he has attained to love and to watchfulness. Unless he has come to that clarity of consciousness which makes one a Buddha, he should not teach. First establish yourself in the way, then teach. And so defeat sorrow. Otherwise, this happens. Listening to a Buddha, his beautiful teachings, and you become so full of the teachings that a great desire arises to teach others. You forget completely that first you have to practice before you can preach. And that's how it is happening all over the world. Once I was taken to a Christian college, one of the biggest in India, where they create missionaries, ministers, priests, etc. I was a little puzzled, how can you create in a college priests, ministers, missionaries? That is impossible. The principal was very much interested in me. He invited me. He said, you come and see. It was a 6-year course. And I looked around the college, a big campus, 700 people were getting ready to become priests, preachers, teachers. I looked around, I went into many classes, and what I saw was really hilarious. It was so ridiculous. In one class, the teacher was telling to the students that when you give this sermon, how you have to stand. And when you come to this point, how you have to raise your hands. What gestures to make. How you have to close your eyes as if you have gone in a deep, deep meditation. As if. Don't forget the as if. They are learning like actors. In Pune there is a film institute where they prepare actors. That I can understand. Acting can be taught. Even there, I have never heard that film institutes have created great actors. But one can understand that acting can be taught. Even though great actors have not been created by film institutes, even there it fails. Actors are also born like poets. Because acting is poetry. It is art. You have to have an inborn spirit. Everybody cannot be an actor. Because one has to get so much involved in the act. So deeply involved that one forgets that one is separate. One has to lose one's identity in the acting. One has to become one's part. One has to forget everything about himself. This is no ordinary feat. But one can think that acting can be taught. But how can you teach people to become masters? Taking leave of the principal, I told him one story that I have heard. It must have happened in some college like yours. The teacher was telling to the students that when you talk about paradise, heaven, smile, heavenly smile. Your eyes full of joy and light and look upwards towards heaven and for a moment become silent. And just let people see how joyous, full of light and joy you are. A student raised his hand and he said, that's right. But when we are talking about hell, what to do? The teacher said, then, just as you are will do. Just stand as you are. You need not do anything else. Just be yourself, that's all. And that will show them what hell is. teaching people to become masters is such an absurdity. Jesus has not learned in any college. It is fortunate that such colleges did not exist in those days. Otherwise, they may have destroyed Jesus. Buddha had never gone to any religious institution to learn. Religion has to be lived, because that is the only way to learn it. Buddha says, and so defeat sorrow. Love, watch, become an enlightened person, then teaching will be simple. Then it will start flowing from you. You will be teaching by your walk, by your sitting, by your silence, by your talking. You will be continuously teaching in every possible way. To live with a master is to be constantly showered by his teaching, whatsoever he is doing, his way of doing has a totally different fragrance. It is in the world, but not of the world. To straighten the crooked, you must first do a harder thing. Straighten yourself. It is easy to look at people's faults. One loves to see people's faults, because that helps and strengthens your ego, that I am far superior. It is very difficult to see one's own faults. Only a man who loves himself can see them. Don't listen to others what they say about you. See yourself, who you are, where you are, what are your faults. And the miracle is, seeing a fault by your own awareness dissolves it. You need not make any effort to dissolve it. The very awareness is enough. It starts melting like ice in the hot sun. But it is very difficult to see one's own faults, because you never look at yourself. You are constantly extrovert, looking at others. The Shapley new stenographer gave a piece of paper to the company auditor saying, here is that report you wanted, Mr. Barry. My name is Mr. Perry. He corrected. You must have been talking to the head bookkeeper, who can't pronounce his P's right. Did he say anything about me? Only that when it comes to meaningless details, you are a regular brick. It is certainly difficult, because you have to turn your whole consciousness towards yourself. And we have become so extrovert, we have been made so extrovert, that introversion seems to be almost impossible. We are paralyzed. We can look only at others. Even if we want to look at ourselves, we have to look in a mirror. Then the image in the mirror becomes the other. One has to learn to look at oneself with closed eyes, to watch silently. And don't carry any prejudices a priori. Many people have told you these are your faults. Don't carry those ideas within you. Otherwise, you will find them. Because thought is very inventive. You put aside all that has been told about you. Remember only one thing. Unless you know it on your own authority, it has no value, no meaning. So go without any prejudice, far or against. Go just in a total openness and see. And if you love and if you know how to watch, you will come across the most mysterious phenomenon. Seeing a fault is dissolving it. That is Buddha's great secret. Knowing that you are doing something wrong is enough. You can't do it anymore. Socrates says, knowledge is virtue. He can be understood only in the light of Buddha. He was misunderstood very much in Greece. Because Greece has produced great philosophers, but not great Buddhas. Only four names are there which can be counted in Buddhas from Greece. Socrates, Pythagoras, Heraclitus, Plotinus. And thousands of names are there of great philosophers. The Greek tragedy is that so many philosophers and so few of Buddhas. Socrates was saying something immensely valuable, but it was out of context. There was no atmosphere in which it can be understood. He was saying, right, knowledge is virtue. If you know something is wrong, it disappears. If you know something is right, you start behaving accordingly. That's what Jesus means when he says, truth liberates. It is enough to know the truth, and liberation happens on its own accord. It is not that first you have to know and then you have to practice. Knowing is enough. It transforms your conscience, and once conscience is transformed, your character follows suit, like a shadow. You are your only master. Who else? Subdue yourself and discover your master. Buddha says, the outer master is nothing but a reflection of the inner. To be with an outer master is for a certain purpose, so that the inner master starts getting synchronized with the outer. The outer is just a provocation, a challenge. But the real function of the master is to help you discover your own master. The real master never makes his followers, disciples, dependents. He helps them to be independent, to be free. He never gives them a certain pattern of life. He only gives them hints how to attain light of their own. He helps them to be themselves. He does not impose his personality on his disciples. This is the criterion to judge whether the master is real or pseudo. If somebody is trying to impose his personality on you, his ideas on you, his character on you, his morality on you, his principles on you, beware. Avoid such a man as quickly as possible. He is dangerous. He is destructive. He may look very loving to you, but his love is poisonous. He may be very sweet, but his sweetness is nothing but poison, sugar-coated. The real master is one who helps you to be yourself, who helps you to be free, even free of himself. The Zen people say, if you meet Buddha on the way, kill him. And they worship Buddha. And still they say, if you meet the Buddha on the way, kill him. They are simply saying what Buddha himself has said. Buddha insisted his whole life, don't follow. Understand. Imbibe my spirit, but don't follow my characters. You will have your own character, which is going to be unique, because no other individual has ever been there who is like you, and no other individual will ever be there who can be like you. You are unique. Don't become imitators. But that's what happens. People become parrots. They repeat what their masters say. They imitate how their masters live. Red was very fond of his male parrot. The parrot had become despondent, and after all sorts of experiments to snap him out of it, Red decided that his feathered friend needed some sex. Red found a beautiful female parrot in a pet shop and paid $50 to have his bird serviced. The female was delivered to Red's house and placed in the male parrot's cage. Instantly the male let out a terrifying scream and began tearing the female's feathers out. "What are you doing?" screeched the female. "For $50, baby," shouted the male, "I want you nude." He may be simply imitating his master. Don't be a parrot. Don't imitate. Be authentic to yourself. Be true to yourself. You are your only master. Who else? Subdue yourself. When Buddha says subdue yourself, he does not mean repress yourself. The translation is not exactly what he means. And there is difficulty to translate him. Because Buddha uses the word self in the sense of ego. He is not a believer in the self. He says any sense of self is nothing but a subtle form of ego. And when he says subdue yourself, he simply means look deep into the idea of your ego and it will be gone. It will disappear. It is a false phenomenon. The idea that I am separate from existence is a false idea, totally false. It needs only a right perception and it will be dissolved. And the moment ego disappears, you can discover your own master. When the ego is not there, who is there? A pure consciousness, a pure awareness, with no center to it, with no content either. No thoughts are there and no center. Just a pure consciousness. A consciousness without any center and without any circumference. That consciousness is nirvana, enlightenment. You have come to your own master. From now onwards, you need not ask anybody. Even if you want to ask, you cannot. All questions have evaporated. All problems have evaporated. This state of no problem, no question, is the state of bliss, of peace, of truth, of freedom. Willfully you have fed your own mischief. Soon it will crush you as the diamond crushes a stone. And remember, whatsoever you have been doing, nobody else is responsible for it. Willfully you have fed your own mischief. It is your own will. It is out of your own choice that you have been doing things which are finally destructive to yourself. In the beginning, they may not appear so. In the end, you will come to know that you have killed yourself, poisoned yourself, slowly, slowly. And because it was such a slow process, you could not become aware. To become aware of slow processes, great watchfulness is needed. I have heard about an experiment. A scientist threw a frog in boiling water. Naturally, the frog immediately jumped out of the water. Instantly. He didn't lose a single moment. It was a question of life and death. He really jumped high as he has never jumped before. And then the scientist put the frog into another bucket of water of the same temperature as the frog's body. The frog was very happy, was resting at the bottom, and then he started heating the water so slowly that it took 24 hours for the water to come to the boiling point. The frog never jumped out of it. He could not become aware. The process was so slow. The increasement in heat was so slow that it needed a Buddha's awareness. You can't expect it from a frog. You can't expect it from people. The frog died. The water was boiling. The frog was boiling, but he won't jump out of it. 24 hours was enough. He became accustomed of slow growth. It was so slow growing that he never could make a discrimination that the water is being heated up. That's what is happening in your life. You go on doing mischief. You go on doing wrong things in the hope that by wrong means one can reach to the right end. This is one of the great fallacies, universal fallacy, that means and ends are not joined together. Wrong means can help you to reach a right end. The fallacy is so prevalent that nobody thinks of it as a fallacy. It is impossible to reach to the right end by wrong means. Wrong means are bound to lead you to wrong ends. But then it is too late. By the time you reach, it is too late. The process cannot be reversed. The whole time is wasted. And you may have become, meanwhile, accustomed with wrong means. You may go on perpetuating those wrong means your whole life. Others may say that this is wrong. And you may even intellectually agree with them. But intellectual agreement never brings any change. Unless you existentially feel that something is wrong, and I am poisoning myself, you will not be able to snap out of it. And we are so clever at rationalizations that we go on doing mischief, thinking that this is not mischief, convincing ourselves that this is not mischief. And we are so skillful with words, with logic, with arguments, that we can prove to others that this is not mischief, that I am doing something great. Joseph Stalin killed millions of people in Russia, and with a very clean conscience, he was never disturbed that he is killing millions of people. In fact, no other person has killed so many people. But he was creating for the great idea of equality, communism, a classless society. Those ideas are great, but those are simply ideas. And for us, just ideas, abstract ideas, abstractions, he was killing real people. And the people who were killed were not rich people. They were poor people. Poor people who were very much attached to their small pieces of land. And they did not want the land to become collective. They were killed. And the beauty is, or the irony, that Stalin was thinking he is killing them for their own sake. Because unless the land belongs to the state, unless a dictatorship of the proletariat is asserted in, the poor people cannot be helped. And it was the poor people who were too much attached to their small things. In Russia there were not many rich people, very few rich people. It was almost like India, very few rich people, and 98% people poor. But poor people have their own attachments, more so, because they have not much, a small land, an old cow, a bullock cart, few hens, and they are very much afraid because this is all they have. There is a story told. A communist was asking to a farmer, "Do you believe in communism or not?" He said, "Yes, I believe in communism." The communist leader asked, "If you had two cars, will you give one to somebody who has none?" He said, "Yes, absolutely yes." "And if you had two houses, will you be willing to give one house to somebody who has none?" He said, "Absolutely." And then the communist leader asked, "If you had two cows, will you give one to the person who has none?" He said, "No, absolutely no." The communist leader said, "But this seems to be absurd. Up to now you were saying yes, yes, yes. Why suddenly no?" He said, "I don't have two cars, I don't have two houses, but I have two cows." When you don't have, what is the problem? You can give everything when you don't have it. You can give to the moon, you can give the sun to anybody who wants. But when it comes to real problems, then it is difficult. poor people were killed. But Joseph Stalin slept well. He was never disturbed that I am killing so many people. And the communist ideology was also a good rationalization for him, because communism believes there is no soul. Consciousness is only a byproduct of matter, an epiphenomenon. So when you kill a person, you are not killing anybody. There is nobody inside. A man is just matter. This was a great help for the murderer, Joseph Stalin. If there is nobody inside, you are not committing any crime. And when you will die, you will die. There is not going to be any afterlife, and there is not going to be any judgment day. People can create philosophies, rationalizations, arguments to do all kinds of mischiefs. And people are ready to believe anything that helps to continue themselves as they are. Holding a butterfly in his palm, Basil walked into a cocktail lounge. "See this butterfly," he shouted. "If somebody will tell me how much this butterfly weighs, I will bestow all my charm on him." "Shut up, you bum," shouted a man at the bar. "It weighs 100 pounds. "Ah, sweetheart, you win." If you want to do something, then anything can be accepted if it helps your desire, your wishes. Lars came home early one afternoon and found his wife lying naked on the bed, breathing heavily. "June, what is the matter?" he asked. "I think I am having a heart attack," she gasped. Quickly, Lars rushed downstairs to phone a doctor. When his son came rushing in and exclaimed, "Daddy, there is a naked man in the front closet." Lars opened the closet door and found his best friend cowering there. "For God's sake, Emil," screamed Lars, "June is having a heart attack, and here you are sneaking around scaring the children. When you want to believe in anything, you can invent all kinds of ideas. Watch how you defend your mischiefs, how you defend your wrongs, your faults. By your own folly, you will be brought as low as your worst enemy wishes. So the creeper chokes the tree. When the creeper starts moving up a tree, the tree feels very good. It is very ego-fulfilling that the creeper needs the tree. Whenever you are needed, you feel good. The tree knows I am strong. And the creeper has to depend on me. The tree wants the creepers, more and more creepers, to go round and round the tree. to have its support. It may think it is doing a great public service, or it may think that it is a great lover, and the creepers are beloveds. Creepers are female, and the trees are all male chauvinistic. But sooner or later, the creepers are going to suffocate the tree, to choke the tree. But then it will be too late. Beware. Be watchful of every step. Today, tomorrow, always. Don't lose a single moment in unawareness, because in unawareness you are bound to do some mischief, and all mischiefs are going to rebound on you sooner or later. Margan, aged 86, was talking to his doctor. About 4 weeks ago, he said, I have picked up an 18-year-old girl, took her to a motel, and we made love all night. 3 weeks ago, I met a 20-year-old, double parked in front of her house, and we did it for 3 hours. Just last week, I grabbed a 17-year-old, took her to the park, and we have been making love for 6 straight days. My goodness, guessed the doctor, picking up all these strange girls, I hope you are using some precautions. Ah, sure, said the old man. I give them a phony name and address. 86 years old, remember. And what precautions he is taking. He is giving phony name and phony address. If you have persisted in your follies your whole life, even dying, you will die full of your follies. Hence, don't postpone for tomorrow. One never knows whether tomorrow will come or not. Start being watchful from this very moment. How hard it is to serve yourself. How easy to lose yourself in mischief and folly. How hard it is to serve yourself. What Buddha means by it? He means how hard it is to be aware, because that is the only true service to yourself. Unless you love yourself immensely, you will not take that arduous journey of being watchful. You can be watchful only if you love yourself so tremendously that you don't want to commit any folly, any mischief, that you don't want to bring any misery for yourself. Be selfish. Because if you are selfish, you will be altruistic. First get rooted into your own being, and then you will be of help to others. But you have been told that if you are selfish, that is bad. Be unselfish. Be altruistic. Help others, serve others, and forget yourself. A mother was telling to his small boy that it is our duty to serve others. God has made you to serve others. The boy thought for a moment and then said, I can understand that. that God has made me to serve others. But why God has made others to serve me? But this seems to be ridiculous. He makes me to serve others, makes others to serve me. Why can't I serve myself and they serve themselves? It will be more simple, less complicated. You have been told to serve others, and you serve. But what service you can do to them? In the name of service, you do all kinds of wrong things to people. You are bound to do wrong things because you are not alert enough. The castor reed dies when it bears fruit. There is a certain reed, castor reed in India, which dies when it bears fruit. So the fool is scorning the teachings of the awakened, is spurning those who follow the law, perishes when his folly flowers. It takes a little time for the seed to grow and become a sprout, and the sprout to grow and become a tree, and the tree also takes time, the right season, to grow flowers, and then fruits come. It takes a time. When you sow the seeds, you don't see the flowers or the fruits. Be watchful when you are sowing your seeds. Because once sown, you will have to suffer the consequences. Whatsoever you sow, you will have to reap. Just the time gap creates illusions in people's minds. They think they can escape. They can sow wrong seeds and can reap right crops. That is impossible. That is against the eternal law. And these are the people, the fools Buddha calls them, who scorn the teachings of the awakened, who will laugh and ridicule the Buddhas. Because the Buddha seems to be enemies to them. They know if Buddhas are right, then their whole life is wrong. And that is too much for them to accept. They know if Buddhas are right, then they are utterly stupid, utterly idiotic, and that is too much for their egos to accept, too humiliating. Hence it is better to crucify a Jesus, poison a Socrates, stone a Buddha, rather than listen to them, scorning the teachings of the awakened, spurning those who follow the law. And those who will listen to the Buddhas and will follow the law, the ultimate law of life, the law of love and the law of meditation. Those who follow, they are being laughed at. People will ridicule them. People will think that you are mad, insane. People will try in every possible way to pull them away from the right path, because their very presence hurts them. When a single person starts meditating, all the non-meditators are against him. He is doing something which raises questions about their lifestyle. And if by meditation he becomes more peaceful and more blissful, then of course they become more and more suspicious of their lifestyle, more and more doubtful. And nobody wants to live in doubt. And it is easier to kill the person, to destroy the person, than to destroy your doubts. It is easier to remove the Buddha, to murder the Buddha, than to become conscious. Christians have never been able to explain why Jesus is crucified. And they have found all kinds of wrong interpretations. They think he is being crucified for the sins of humanity. Utterly stupid. If you commit sin, you will suffer. Why Jesus Christ? Why this poor man? What he has done? Christians say Jesus is crucified because Adam and Eve committed the original sin. Why not crucify Adam and Eve? What this poor carpenter's son has done? He is utterly innocent. He has not committed any sin. And then they say, and they have to find out new and more explanations, because no explanation satisfies. He is chosen to be crucified himself as a sacrifice to save humanity. But humanity is not saved yet. 2,000 years have passed. So one thing is certain, his sacrifice was futile. But all these explanations are wrong. The real thing is that a man who is enlightened is bound to be crucified, killed, murdered by those who have invested deeply into unconsciousness. Buddha reminds you that you can scorn the teachings of the awakened, spurning those who follow the law, but remember, the castor reed dies when it bears fruit, so the fool perishes when his folly flowers. It will not be too long. Soon you will see the fruits of your own actions, and then you will cry and weep, but then it will be too late. Beware. And do two simple things. In fact, simple. But they look arduous because we have been brought up with absolutely wrong conditionings. The first is love yourself, and the second is watch today, tomorrow, always. Enough for today.